Herzlich willkommen zum Fintech-Podcast von Payment & Banking. In unserem wöchentlichen Podcast sprechen wir mit interessanten Köpfen aus der Branche über unsere Hauptthemen Fintech, Payment, Banking und Mobile.
Hallihallo und willkommen zum Fintech-Podcast 198, wenn ich mich nicht verzählt habe. Diesmal aus dem schönen, warmen Singapur in einem schön gekühlten WeWork-Office. Wie immer wäre der Podcast als auch unser Aufenthalt hier nicht möglich, unsere Sponsoren. Unter anderem Mastercard, muss ich glaube ich keinem erzählen, wer oder was Mastercard ist, aber natürlich auch Smartsteuer. Jährlich werden 25 Milliarden Euro in Deutschland an Steuern erstattet, falls ihr das nicht wusstet. Das sind ungefähr 1000 Euro pro Nase und trotzdem sind viele Leute so wie ich und sträuben sich, wenn es um das Thema Steuern geht. Genau deshalb gibt es Smartsteuer. Smartsteuer hat aber nicht nur eine B2C-Seite, also damit wir alle unsere Steuererklärung machen, sondern auch eine B2B-Seite. Stellt euch vor, dass während man seine Steuererklärung macht, poppt plötzlich eure Firma auf und ihr könnt den Solventen, Mitarbeitern oder Kunden sofort irgendetwas anbieten, was für euch gut ist. Sei es eine Versicherung, sei es ein kostenloses Konto oder ähnliches. Wenn ihr mehr wissen wollt zum Thema Steuern und zum Thema, wie ihr partnern könnt mit Smartsteuer, dann geht bitte auf smartsteuer.de, das Wort wird nichts für mich, smartsteuer.de/fintech.
Warum arbeiten Banken eigentlich so gerne mit FinCompare zusammen?
Kundengewinnung, insbesondere die Gewinnung von KMUs, ist für Banken sehr teuer. Die Kundengewinnung wird umso teurer, je mehr Zeit von der Bank während einer Anfrage aufgewandt wurde und die Anfragen mangels Erfüllung der entscheidenden Kriterien dann doch von der Bank abgelehnt werden müssen. FinCompare bietet einen entscheidenden Kostenvorteil für die Kundengewinnung, indem die Anfragen der KMUs mit den Anforderungen der Banken online gematcht werden. Dadurch müssen keine Ressourcen für Kunden ohne Potenzial aufgewendet werden. Außerdem erhöht sich die Abschlusswahrscheinlichkeit um 80%. Gerne erzähle ich euch hierzu später mehr.
So viel dazu, aber kommen wir zurück nach Singapur. Ich möchte heute euch einen Gast vorstellen, den ihr hoffentlich noch öfter hören wird. Und zwar, jetzt switche ich auf Englisch. Our guest today is Zenon from Capron Asia. Hi Zenon, how are you?
Great, thanks for having me here today, Raphael.
Zenon, tell our listeners, not readers, our listeners a little bit about yourself, what you're doing, and what is the thing that brings you to Singapore. Maybe also why you're back in Singapore right now.
Sure. So my name is Zenon Capron. I was born in Canada, grew up in the U.S., studied computer science undergraduate, and then went to work for Citibank. So I worked for Citibank in the U.S. and then in Europe. Closest to your listeners probably was Zurich, where I was for a year and a half, working at Citibank in Bahnhof, near Bahnhof Enge, if you're familiar with Zurich. And then when I left the company, I was the head of technology for Citigroup in Portugal, so looking after all the operations and engineering for the organization there. I left to do my MBA, and that was my first trip out to Asia. I went to INSEAD, and I took advantage of their dual campuses to come out to Singapore here in 2004, where the country looked quite a bit different than it does today.
Indeed.
When I graduated, I had a couple of opportunities, but China was really on the radar for a lot of people. From a business perspective, it certainly was, and still is, very much a growing economy and one of the hot spots, certainly in Asia, if not globally. And so when the opportunity came up to work for Intel, looking after sales and marketing in Asia for them, for the financial services industry, it just made a lot of sense, both from a career track and then location. Just an opportunity to come to Asia, because it was, having spent 5 years in Europe and then growing up in North America, I felt like I knew those economies, so it was either South America or Asia, and this opportunity made a lot of sense for me. So I stayed at Intel for 2 years, and basically my responsibility was, how do we take a chip and make it relevant for a bank? Mm-hmm. So if you think about a chip, a very commoditized component at this day. So we would work with companies like Oracle and IBM to create push marketing programs, and then we would work with the banks to create pull. So why is an Intel chip better than AMD or one of the other players? Intel's focus shifted, and they moved away from a vertical approach to more of a horizontal approach. approach. Since my experience had always been in financial technology, I decided to leave the company and set up Capron Asia shortly afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so fundamentally, we are a market research and consulting company focused on the Asian financial industry. So mm-hmm. we cover banking, payments, capital markets. Mm-hmm. And our clients tend to be financial technology companies, so Intel is a client, IBM, Oracle, as well as companies very specific to the market. So companies like Finastra, FIS, ACI, VocaLink, MasterCard, a lot of payments companies, as well as banking, capital markets, and then financial institutions themselves. So we've done work with Macquarie, NatWest, numerous different organizations. Okay. And it's a combination of research, so we publish independent research reports and content on our website, as well as consulting, so mm-hmm. looking at specific client challenges around Asia. Mm-hmm. We started off in China with a Shanghai office, and I lived in Shanghai for about 14 years. And then with the birth of our son in September, my wife suggested to move to Singapore. And as she's Singaporean, it just made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And so it's been, we still keep the Shanghai office, and yeah. we've started to build out our Singapore office as well. But just the environment. You know, I think both from a personal perspective and a financial services perspective, I think often Singapore gets the rap as being kind of the boring place. And because of the market, the financial industry market here is relatively small. I mean, you're serving a population of 6 million people as opposed to Indonesia, where it's, you know, talking about hundreds of millions and all of the surrounding areas. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, in this region, the stability, the infrastructure, the legal framework that's here in Singapore makes it very attractive. Mm-hmm. And so it's been very interesting for us to make that transition, you know, from looking at China with a digital play, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but then, you know, in Southeast Asia, there's a lot that's happening here as well, which I think was evident at the event earlier this week.
True. So one of the things that I'm very pleased about is that both of our firms, Payment and Banking and Capron Asia, will be exchanging a little bit of content. So as we always try to tell our listeners, don't always look west, also look a little bit east. I'm very pleased because I'm a reader on this time on your content. So I'm very pleased to announce that actually most of the research papers that are publicly available will also be publicly available to our Payment and Banking readers and listeners. So I think that because I know your research and I've seen you a couple of times, not only presenting, but you were also chairing on the Money 2020, you had your own panel, you were also on the main stage this time. So I think that it is invaluable for us in Europe to have somebody like you that translates, right? Mm-hmm. That actually tells the rest of the world, like, how do you read Asia? How do you do these things? What does it mean when Tencent drops 5 million on a company? Is that really relevant, or is that something that is, yeah, just day-to-day business that actually nobody even cares about because it's that little money. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about a little bit about the Money 2020. So what did you see that was new, that stood out for you this year in comparison to last year?
Mm. I think the developments that we've seen in general kind of match our view on what's happening in the market. Mm-hmm. I think the couple of things, I mean, if we look at traditional payments in Southeast Asia, you know, real-time payments has really picked up. You know, you have countries like Hong Kong, Australia, Malaysia that have recently gone, and other countries that are in the pipeline, to the point that we should see in ASEAN, you know, pretty much all of the countries have modernized payment infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of standardized messaging and real-time platforms. Yeah. And I think that opens up a lot of really interesting opportunities for cross-border. Yeah. You know, one of the challenges that Asia has is that it's very fragmented in terms of culture, people, and regulations. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we haven't seen a SEPA framework for Asia. The closest we have is kind of the ASEAN payment network that really is still at its early stages. But the modernization of all of the infrastructure across Southeast Asia gives us a unique opportunity. And so I think we'll start to see more integration between these platforms. So, you know, we're already seeing you can go to the just across the border into Malaysia, and you can use a QR code from the PayNow system here in Singapore to pay for your goods in Malaysia. And so that cross-border QR code interoperability, I think, will be quite interesting. QR codes would be another trend. You know, I think they started off in China, but the hardware independence, the low cost, the easy integration and the standardization has making QR codes, even above NFC, very interesting, compelling for merchants and consumers. Mm-hmm. And then the last trend is really platformication. I mean, the fact that, again, you know, something that started in China with Alipay and WeChat Pay is that you have these apps that you do everything. I mean, the Chinese, there's 800 million Chinese consumers that use WeChat on a regular basis. Yeah. And they're not just using it for chatting with their friends, but they're making payments, they're booking travel, they're shared rides, ordering food.
Didn't they say something like 90 minutes usage per day? I think that was one of the numbers that was thrown around on the conference. That's insane. I mean, if you imagine like how much time people are spending on these apps on a day-to-day basis, that is like, forget about the operating system of the phone. It's like WeChat became the operating system on top of the operating system.
Yeah, and a lot of that is down to the hardware that people use. So if you look at PC ownership in the US as an example, PC ownership in terms of households that have a computer is about 80 to 85%. In China, that number is about 50%. But 75%, nearly 75% of all the phones that are sold in China are smartphones. And smartphones, because of the producers like Xiaomi, Huawei, Oppo, that are able to produce, you know, very high quality Android phones for less than $100, those become the devices of choice for individuals. Yeah. So millennials, adults, you know, that's the way they connect with each other, and you know, the communications tends to be around that one standard WeChat or a couple of the other platforms that are being used. So yeah, the stickiness of these applications, and I think that really drove the development. I mean, if you look at Alipay started with its roots in e-commerce, and so it has built from that, and e-commerce really is the base. In WeChat, it was communications, entertainment, gaming that drove adoption.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing that came out of Money 2020 this week is, you know, you refer to Alipay and WeChat Pay as the super apps, right? Super apps in China. And people are talking about, okay, well, are Grab and Gojek super apps? But the interesting thing about that is they could be super apps, but for a different reason.
Yeah.
Because if you think about the apps in China, it's the consumers that have them open all day. So WeChat in particular, you have it open all day. And if you look at the average amount transacted, WeChat tends to be a smaller amount because that's, you know, you're going into the 7-Eleven, you're going to the Starbucks, you're buying a coffee.
Yeah.
Whereas Alipay, it tends to be more, like you need to have a reason to go into the Alipay
app. But it's more the high ticket sales that you have, right?
Yeah. Well, it's not everyday purchases. It's you need to have a reason to go into the app. It's not you're chatting with friends and, oh, I have to pay for this, so I'll just, you know, pay for it with that. With Grab and Gojek, kind of the two dominant platforms here in Southeast Asia, for the consumers, Grab you may use three times per day. And for your listeners that may not be familiar with Grab, Grab started off with kind of its Uber-esque platform that allows you to book shared rides and now increasingly order food and deliveries and things like this. But for the merchants, which the merchants in this case would be the drivers, they do have that app open all the time. So, you know, in China, we have it's a super app because all of the consumers are using it. But in Southeast Asia, we may see these apps becoming super apps because it's the merchants that are using it all the time. So, you know, we saw earlier this week the announcement between Zhongan, which is the digital insurance company, and Grab tying up providing insurance to drivers. And so that, you know, we could see, of course, it doesn't have, you know, you don't have as many drivers as you do consumers in these markets. But for those drivers, this could very well be, you know, a financial platform and a super app.
Plus, it could be life-changing, right? So what we see, even if you go back to the U.S., we have this, how do you call it, the hourly rate worker, the new hourly rate worker, so to speak, that works for platforms like Uber, Lyft, or other things, like delivering stuff. And if you take a look at the Grab drivers, maybe not in Singapore, but in Indonesia, that's the first time that they have like a proper job and a quote-unquote steady income. But that actually means that they become like the enablers for the whole family. And obviously, if they are on Grab, the other people will be going on Grab. One of the things that I found very interesting, not from the Grab perspective, but the split second that I think it was WeChat, when they landed in Malaysia, from day one, they had 20 million people enabling the app and working on that. And even though Malaysia is not traditionally Chinese, they were even capable to bring this red packet part over that and transform that. So that's super interesting that Grab, Gojek could maybe go the same path, but actually coming more from a, you call them merchant, but in the end, it's like the worker perspective, right? Yeah. So it's somebody that actually works for these platforms, and now it becomes the super app for them, and maybe they make the leap and the jump to the B2C side, but that's remains to be seen.
Yeah. I think making that crossover is going to be a little bit more challenging because they don't really, there's, again, you're not using Grab all the time. It's a destination app.
You know,
you're using it when you want food, or if they can make it that compelling. We've seen a communications app move into finance, like with the WeChat example, and potentially like what with Facebook is doing and with WhatsApp.
Yeah.
But we haven't seen the opposite. We haven't seen Alipay try to create a chat app. And we do work
well.
Well, we do work with Ant Financial, and whenever we communicate with them, we have to use their app. We don't communicate with any of our other contacts on that.
Yeah.
So they've tried to do that, but you know the question will be if they're able to do that or not. Mm.
Do you see that Grab and Gojek as like the quote unquote, let's call them super apps for a moment, even though they might be even slightly smaller. Do you see that they have a fighting chance in Southeast Asia because they are born out of Southeast Asia versus the Chinese titans going into Southeast Asia?
This is going to be one of the big questions for the next 5 years, and something that we talked about when we were on the stage with a couple of these guys over the past week is, you know, China, the road to China, I like to say this, the road to China is littered by the corpses of technology companies that have failed. I mean, if you look back in the payment space specifically, if you look at PayPal, there's no reason that PayPal could not have been successful in China.
Yeah.
There was no regulations at the time.
Yeah.
They were tied up with eBay, but you know, but the nature of their model was to scale globally using the same back end, the same interface. So if you use PayPal in the US versus Germany versus the UK, it's roughly the same interface.
Yeah.
Different language, but same idea, right?
Yeah.
They didn't adopt it for local standards. And so the nature of Chinese consumption is very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in that respect, they kind of failed in this market. So the real question will be now, would the companies like Ant Financials and Tencent and Zhongyan's, do they learn from that when they move into the other markets? Because I think, going back to part of your question there, the Grab and Gojek really do understand the markets here in Southeast Asia because that's where they're from.
I mean, exactly.
There's Southeast Asia native apps.
Yeah.
And I think, there's a lot of... it's easy to dismiss what they do as PR in terms of the financial inclusion and goodness of the app. But we have talked to individuals in China and around Southeast Asia and South Asia about the impact that these digital platforms have had on their lives. And it's amazing. It's amazing because in many places like China, unbanked is not a problem.
Yeah.
China, 85% of the population has access to a bank.
Mm-hmm.
Underbanked is a tremendous issue because credit scoring is poor.
Yeah.
Banks, historically, interest rates have been fixed, mm-hmm. so they're more likely to lend to state-owned enterprises mm-hmm. than individuals. And you see the same thing across Asia. But these digital platforms, because of the data, I mean, the downside is the data that they collect. But the flip side is the economic empowerment that they give individuals so that driver in Jakarta who may not have had an opportunity to make money is able to do that.
Right.
And it's very easy to criticize some of the business models that they have and, you know, how much money the drivers are getting. But realistically, the governments and the banks are not able to service this industry
True.
In an effective way.
True.
And they've really created a phenomenal
Yeah.
flow of economic empowerment and financial inclusion.
I think that it comes across very genuinely. So one of the presentations that I like the most actually from the whole conference was the OVO CEO, which is actually a Western guy, but he was presenting very humbly and actually explaining like the OVO is Indonesia based, how they're making an impact. And I was smiling in my head because you go to Silicon Valley and everybody is like, saying the same thing. But you know that's actually just a lip service, right? Everybody wants to change the world. But here, with something very, very small, right? And he was giving the examples of stall owners that create something that they couldn't branch out, that they actually, the example that he was giving was, I think, a stall owner that was selling food. And he literally couldn't afford to have a second kid because he couldn't afford the education. For that, he would need to actually branch out. For that, he would actually need to have credit. He would need to find somebody that lends money to him, which, as you just said, a traditional bank, he doesn't have a credit score. He doesn't have the background. So without that, yes, of course, he pretty much, quote unquote, sells your soul. If you ask a European privacy person, he sells your soul to the platform. But that's the only way for him to afford a second kid. So how easy is that decision for him?
Yeah.
Right? So it is, I think, something where these platforms can make a change. Now, the question is, do you need to have one platform that rules them all? I think that's where maybe the freaky part could start. Or do you need to have one national champion? That Indonesia is big enough, Malaysia is big enough, right? Philippines is big enough. Or does it have to be this one thing that actually rules everything?
I think it's interesting to follow the funding in a lot of this as well, because if you look back, SoftBank in particular is very active in Southeast Asia with the ride services, and people say that they engineered the Grab takeover of Uber in the market, and so I think some of this may be driven by where the money is coming from, because there's clearly SoftBank has a vision of creating a platform across all of these regions.
Makes sense.
And other companies as well. I mean, Ant Financial, that's already heavily funded, is looking at creating a global wallet that can be used anywhere for remittances and presumably e-commerce and everything else that they offer as well. So I think a lot of that could be driven by that. I don't know that the answer really matters either, because if it certainly it matters for the shareholders and for the investors, but if we believe that these companies are providing a public good, and at least so far they haven't reached the notoriousness of some of the U.S. technology platforms in terms of using the data, if they continue in that direction, then it doesn't matter if there's one or if there's one for every country, as long as they're providing that basic level of financial empowerment that the banks and the regulators can't provide on their own, then there's benefits with that.
Okay, good. Hier noch einmal kurz die Erinnerung, dass dieser Podcast nicht möglich wäre ohne unsere Sponsoren, nämlich Mastercard, vielen Dank dafür, und auch Smart Steuer. Wenn ihr mehr über Smart Steuer erfahren wollt, geht bitte auf smartsteuer.de/fintech. Zenon, there was one thing that stood out for me. Last year, when that was the first edition in Singapore, Money 2020, everybody had the question, oh, are the Chinese coming to Southeast Asia or not? And of course, they were always saying the same thing, which is, we'll just follow the Chinese tourist, which is like, I think, one of the biggest scams and distractions that they are playing worldwide. This year, we had a different question, which is like, how are you internationalizing? And everybody was like, yeah, so we do it like A, B, C, D. So what happened in between? It's only 12 months. Last year we were asking how and if, and this time now we're talking like, these are the steps that we're taking. So were they playing us for fools, like always?
Well, so there's a trend that's happening in China right now that I think has driven a lot of this. And it wasn't necessarily set on stage because it's something that isn't advertised so much by the big companies, but there's a lot of regulatory pressure for these companies to be technology providers. Mm-hmm. So Ant Financial, Tencent, these companies are getting to the scales that they become systemically important.
Yeah.
And the regulators effectively went to them and said, look, if you become systemically important, we're going to regulate you like banks. Mm-hmm. And that has a number of implications. I mean, first of all, that decreases your agility because you have a lot of compliance requirements and regulatory reporting requirements. Second of all, the market that sees you as a technology company today sees you as a bank tomorrow, and that assumes a different private PE ratio,
yeah.
and you know,
valuation collapses.
Yeah, I mean, other much. Challenges around that. So that's left these companies with the task of continuing to grow mm-hmm. in that environment, mm-hmm. and most recently, one of the regulations was that historically Alipay and Tencent would keep the money that was stored on the users' wallets.
Yeah.
So they have, you know, 100 billion renminbi in deposits, and they're able to invest that and make money off of that, mm-hmm. you know, under a reasonable amount. The requirement now is, as of about a month ago, all of that money had to be with a custodial bank,
yeah.
and not earning interest,
yeah.
because it was becoming too risky, in, at least in the regulators' minds.
Yeah.
So these companies have had to rely more on technology mm-hmm. to drive their business going forward. Yeah. And whilst, you know, China is a huge market, there is opportunities overseas as well. So I think, you know, in my mind, it's not so much the openness and the clarity of their overseas plans, but the shift in thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the Zhongyan Grab partnership that was announced earlier this week, Zhongyan is a technology provider. They're not providing the underwriting.
Yeah.
They're not providing the insurance policies.
Yeah.
They are just providing the technology on the back end. And we've seen that with Ant Financial and Tencent and Ping An and Zhongyan, as well as some of the peer-to-peer lending platforms. I mean, mm-hmm. some of them are providing technology services to overseas markets.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory always was, you know, these companies were following the Chinese tourists to start. And that, you know, so when you go to Frankfurt and, you know, you want to go to a luxury store, they accept Alipay, right? So it makes
sure.
it very easy for the Chinese
sure.
tourist. I would normally say Paris, but, you know... I don't know how big of a destination of Chinese tourists.
To be
Frankfurt
honest, it's like Munich, Frankfurt. It's like the normal cities,
yeah.
and you can see. I was laughing because right now we were running through the shopping center around here, and you could see that. Obviously, Alipay was running some sort of promotion because within a second, from zero to nothing, like the whole store filled up with Chinese tourists where, you know, okay, and everybody has his phone and everybody has Alipay, and that's how they were running some sort of, there's a promotion, if you go there, 10% off or whatever, they really funnel the people into the retailers if they want to. So that's something that you can still do. Now, you said regulatory pressure. I mean, we saw a couple of things, even from the outside, from Europe. We saw the crackdown on peer-to-peer lending, where they were forced to consolidate into, let's say, a more regulated market. Now we see a little bit of the crackdown into alternative lending, where they say, okay, no more funny business, no more 6-10% interest rates, whatever. So is this pressure just to... Is this the way of the regulator in China to innovate first, regulate later? And what's next after alternative lending?
Yep. So I think when you look at fintech in China in particular, the regulators took a very much a wait-and-see approach mm-hmm. at the very beginning. As an example, payments were first... Alipay was the first online payment provider, and they launched in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Licenses were issued in 2011, and then regulations only came out in about 2015, 2016 around mobile payments and digital payments in China.
Yeah.
Similarly, peer-to-peer lending launched in 2007, 2008, at least online,
mm-hmm.
and was only regulated in 2016, 2017.
Yeah.
The regulators saw a lot of benefits in these platforms. So if you think back to the financial inclusion benefits that we talked about previously and some of the examples, when you have the financial industry as it is in China, the lending tends to go towards the state-owned enterprises as opposed to the consumers and SMEs. So peer-to-peer platforms provide a valuable source of funding for companies or individuals that may need it. And indeed, the peer-to-peer lending space in China is more driven by lending to companies than individuals.
Yeah.
So in the U.S., it might be somebody paying down their credit card debt or their student loans, but in China, it tends to be companies that are looking for short-term capital
mm-hmm.
to be able to access that. Similarly, mobile payments, you know, provide all that financial inclusion, the security, transparency, economic empowerment that payments provide. So the government was quite happy to let these platforms grow because it provides a lot of benefits for the financial industry and for the economy as a whole. But I think what we've seen over the past couple of years is that things have gotten a bit out of control in some of these markets. Now, we did our first report on peer-to-peer lending in probably 2015, 2016, and the analyst at the time that was working on it was explaining to me how the platforms work, and they say, and she said, so the returns around that time were about 14-15% on some of these platforms, sometimes even higher. And she said, yeah, so they guarantee the returns and they guarantee the capital. And then, you know, this is the way the platforms are developing, and they're going, and I said, wait, let's go back for a second. What did you just say? She said, they guarantee the capital and they guarantee the returns. And indeed, they were. Yeah. You would put 1,000 RMB on this platform and they guarantee that you will get your 14% on that 1,000 RMB and you'll get your 1,000 RMB back. And if any advisor comes to you and says, I'm going to give you 15% and I'm going to guarantee it.
That looks like a scam.
It smells like runaway.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
It smells like something's slightly fishy. So you have that happening on the platforms, the guaranteeing returns. You had people using the peer-to-peer lending platforms to borrow the deposit for their mortgage. So they would go to the bank, they would get the mortgage, and then the 20% that they needed for the down payment, they borrowed off the peer-to-peer lending platform. So there was a lot of dodgy activities that were happening on these platforms, and the government was likely right to step in on that. Now, I think what we've seen specifically in the peer-to-peer lending space is that the rot was quite a bit deeper than we thought. And we've actually been quite surprised with some of the platforms that are now actually struggling. I mean, the Lufaxes of the world are still doing well, but some of the, you know, reasonably well-run champions have struggled. And that's partially down to the regulators, but, you know, partially down to a market that was just growing too quickly. And similar in mobile payments. I mean, there is a lot of risk in these platforms, you know, storing all of the money in one place. So certainly over the past couple of years, the government has cracked down a lot more on that and sought to control these platforms.
How do you see the whole personal investment wealth part? I mean, there's like from zero to nothing. I think it's one of the end financial parts that became now the largest mutual fund in the world. It just led JP Morgan and Fidelity into the dust. And especially with the trend that we see in maybe the other end, which is the OVO fund, where you can actually move T0 up to 1 rupee back and forth into the wealth. There is no wealth establishment, so to speak. There's the family offices, that's very fragmented, but you don't have like the UBSs or the Fidelities or the lack of other names, Cities, Deutsche Bank or whatever. All of that thing you don't have, and wealth is defined slightly different here on a slightly different scale. So is that, if we're making a bridge a little bit more into banking, how do you see that trend? Is that something that tomorrow will also be a crackdown on that wealth part and the investment part?
Well, I'm not familiar with OVO on the back end and in terms of how that's structured, but just speaking about UABAL, which is the product that Ant Financial launched a number of years ago, fundamentally, Ant Financial and Alipay are a distribution channel for that financial product. So the financial product still sits within a traditional asset management company and it's regulated as a traditional asset management product. In Asia, as you rightly mentioned, I mean, wealth management in China and Southeast Asia typically refers to mass wealth management rather than, you know, private wealth management. It's very expensive, first of all, to service individuals in the region. You know, the UBSs, the Citibanks are here, but they're not catering to the guy who's, you know, driving for Grab. They're catering towards the wealthy elite that live in the countries as well. Just because it's very expensive to deal with the Grab driver as opposed to, you know, you know, manufacturing conglomerates, Scion or Sun. So these platforms have come to fill in the gap. And if you look at the initial product that UABAL launched, it was very simply an overnight lending product. And so liquidity was very tight in the overnight market, the interbank lending market. It was about 8% if you wanted to borrow money as a bank. So they were able to offer this UABAL product that invested in that market and provided 6 to 7% return to the individuals. Now, of course, that is a very attractive turn for what is effectively instant liquidity. So you could deposit your money today as little as one renminbi or yeah. one rupiah and take it out tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, start earning interest tomorrow and, yeah. And have it back into your account within an hour of requesting it. Yeah. And that, if you look at traditional mass wealth management in China and many of these places, you'd have very high minimums. So, mm-hmm. you know, it may be a minimum of $1,000 equivalent yeah. to invest. And then your money might be tied up for at least a month, if mm-hmm. not much more. Mm-hmm. And then actually getting it, you'd have to sit down with a salesperson in the bank and go through all these forms and everything else. And yeah. UAPAO was brilliant because you'd just be on the metro going home and you register. And originally it was open to foreigners, and I used it myself. And it was very satisfying. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just put 100 renminbi, you know, $15 into the wealth management, and you come back tomorrow and you see I made 0.32 renminbi mm-hmm. or 0.34 renminbi or 0.36 renminbi, and you can see your wealth accumulate. Yeah. It's very satisfying as you know.
Also very appealing to the Chinese, like the yeah. gambling idea of the longer I can do that, the more I earn. So they sure. they play and cater very good to yeah. the culture, right?
Well, you know, even I would argue even for a German or you know somebody
don't do that in China.
Yeah.
It would be a scam from the get-go if you do everything with returns or overnight. Or if it is too easy, then it can't be good.
But I think in general that you know the idea of a compounding interest or you know seeing the returns, that's a general human nature
yeah,
thing. I mean,
sense.
Of course, the gambling aspect, yeah, that plays well into it as well. But you know that opened up it democratized wealth management mm-hmm. in Asia because it opens it up to an entirely new swath of people that wouldn't be able to afford to put $1,000 away for a month. I mean, that's for many people that's a significant chunk of their yearly salary.
Yeah.
So with having these platforms there, that made it very easy for people to invest and at very competitive rates as well. I mean, if you were a rich individual, you know, the access to wealth management products would be kind of similar. You'd be
True.
Getting, you know, 6 or 7% return.
Yeah.
It's not unlike what you would get as an individual, you know, just a regular person on the street.
Now, so far we've been talking a lot about Southeast Asia, what could happen there with Grab and Gojek. We've been touching a little bit on China. Now there's the other elephant, pun intended, in the room, which is obviously India. Mm. Being there, also you see kind of interesting regulations going on. You had the crackdown on the platforms right now, so where Amazon and a little bit of Walmart got exposed on Flipkart with the regulation on changing in e-commerce parts. But also you had this, I'm always pronouncing the database wrong, but the national database where all of the data was in there and everybody was like, what is the name?
Aadhaar.
Yes. I'm always getting that one wrong. But you had India being, from a KYC perspective, being somewhere in the Stone Age. Now you could use the database. Everybody was like, oh my God, we're now in the future. And now they closed the database for using it for KYC. Now we're back into the Stone Age. So what's going on with India? You do the research. You see the subcontinent, what it is. So what do you see going on there?
I mean, this is getting a little bit outside of the scope of the topic of this podcast, but
yeah.
you know, if we look at the macro issues, I mean, India is a democracy, and that has pluses and minuses. And one of the minuses is often there's challenges around, you know, going in one direction and sticking with it. China, being you know, kind of a socialism with capitalistic characteristics, mm-hmm. is able to drive in a particular direction and keep that momentum going.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, when you look at India over the past couple of years, I mean, not only Aadhaar, but the demonetization that they had, that caused quite a bit of disruption in everyday lives for many
yeah.
people. I mean, it had admirable goals at the end of the day, but the way it was implemented was kind of challenging. And so I think there's India is so diverse and so dynamic in many of these ways that there's a lot of other issues that come into play that I think are hindering what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, I mean, India struggles with unbanked mm-hmm. population, a huge unbanked population, as does most of Southeast Asia. So there are tremendous opportunities there,
mm-hmm.
and there's fintech that is there. But certainly, when you push back and you move away from things like Aadhaar, that, again, it makes a lot of sense having a national ID, especially for a country that large.
Yeah.
And China's managed to do that reasonably well. I mean, there's some people that are a little bit excluded from the system, but in general, you know, most people have the national ID, and that helps. It's been challenging, I think, and that could... I think that's one of the reasons that India has struggled to really be cohesive around fintech in general in certain areas. I think it's certainly there's been tremendous growth there, but it could have been more had some of this been planned out potentially a little bit better.
So do you see something like an Ant Financial or like a Gojek or an OVO popping out of India, or do you think it will be more diverse, and maybe it will... They eventually will get there, but maybe it will take longer, and it will take more companies to actually create this one national or this two national champions on that part.
I think we'll definitely see national champions, and when you say pop out, I think pop out domestically, certainly.
Yeah.
Pop out internationally, that might take a little bit more time, I think, for those platforms to expand internationally. But if you look at companies like PayU or Paytm, I mean, Paytm took heavy... Alibaba investment, so that's been very helpful for them in terms of building out their offering and getting a little bit more into the e-commerce side of things. And you have companies like Flipkart that are starting to provide financing for merchants, but now for individuals as well. So I think as they start to move into that, these larger companies don't... I mean, the KYC is important, but you can accomplish that without Aadhaar as well. And if you
it was so much easier to do that with it.
Yeah. But for these large companies that already have scale, I think Aadhaar benefits the smaller companies because then it's just plug and play KYC. But if you're a platform that already has millions of merchants and millions of consumers online in your database, then, you know, you don't really need to do that. And so I think that from that perspective, it'll be very for the bigger guys, I don't think it'll be as much of a hindrance. But I think certainly the nature of India is so unique in terms of the multiple different, you know, the dialects and the cultures even within the country, that it will be a domestic national champion. I can't see, certainly, I mean, when you look at the Alibaba investment, they invested in Paytm rather than trying to go natively to the country.
Yeah, makes sense.
And you do that for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, Hong Kong, okay, fine. Hong Kong is, you know, part of China, and it's, you know, very similar culturally, so it's very easy to make that transition. But then India is a step beyond.
Yeah. Now, we can't talk about this region, obviously also coming from a European background, without the data play. We touched a little bit on it earlier, that people like Grab, Gojek, and everybody else do pretty much something simple. You give me the data, I give you services. Obviously, there's this maybe a little bit over-exaggerated point of view in Europe, that in China you don't have privacy, you have face recognition everywhere, your WeChat knows everything about you. In Europe you see the GDPR going into effect, you have in California something now similar. And there's been talks, and I think also regulation in China, going down that path as well. So how do you see in China data privacy or data privacy pushback happening, and then in the wider region in Southeast Asia? Is that a topic of discussion? Is that something that you can feel, that you can see, that people take more and more serious?
Certainly. I think, and indeed, from what I've read, the privacy laws that China are looking at is potentially even more stringent than GDPR in the use of some of the information, which is
it would be surprising to everybody.
How can you go beyond 100%? It goes all the way to 11. I think there's, you know, we've done studies of millennials and in China in particular, and clearly there is a general acceptance that a certain amount of data is already available to the government and to the players that are there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been kind of this tacit acceptance or conscious acceptance that giving up a bit of data for some benefits is something that people are willing to do. I mean, we're sitting here and we've got a mobile phone on the table, yeah. And that mobile phone, you know, the I don't know what the German Secret Service is, but, you know, certainly on my phone.
This is a Google phone, so yeah, we're pretty much done.
Yeah, the U.S. Secret Service. I mean, so I have a Chinese mobile, and you know, I don't know what's been put in there, but, you know, certainly the Singapore government can track me, and sure. The U.S. government likely as well.
Yeah.
But we make those choices because of the convenience that it offers, right? Yeah. And the same thing with Facebook. I mean, it's caveat emptor. You when you go onto the platform, sure, they were using our data in ways that we didn't know, but there's a huge terms and conditions that's sitting on there that I didn't read, and I'm sure
nobody did.
So we've consciously given away for access to better quality products and services. Mm-hmm. And so the studies that we've done in China around that have shown that Chinese consumers are no different, but there's the added wrinkle that they feel like they didn't necessarily have the privacy to begin with. They are starting to become more conscious about that, though. Mm-hmm. So when we were looking at this a couple of years ago, the Alipay terms and conditions said that they would share your data with partners. Mm-hmm. And it didn't define who the partners were. It didn't define what data could be shared. It was just very vague. Since then, they've tightened that down, and they've made education around privacy and data a key part of both the Alipay platform, and then Tencent has done a similar exercise with WeChat. So there's a lot more clarity around how the data is being used in the market. The government is very stringent around customer data as well in general. So if you're a bank, your core banking system and all of your customer data for Chinese nationals needs to be onshore, and can't cross over. And that's very, very strictly enforced for the banks. And that, you know, across many different industries, that's increasingly being the case, is there's a lot of protection around that. Now, that doesn't talk about, you know, what the government is able to do with the data, but that's probably a separate discussion.
Yeah.
But there is certainly a bigger acceptance that people understand that their data is valuable and that they're giving up a lot of data.
Yeah.
Now, from my personal opinion, I believe, after having lived in China for a while, I think, you know, the idea of personal privacy is kind of going away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, GDPR is kind of moving in one direction, and California is moving in one direction as well. But ultimately, I think just the nature of humankind is that we're getting these additional products and services, we're getting benefits from that, we're willing to give up some information around that. And so I think you kind of have to live your life in a way that, you know, if it is exposed, that you're not going to have problems. And as long as you're not a politician, or even if you are, like in the U.S. right now, it doesn't seem to matter what your history is. But the you kind of just have to make the assumption that that's the way it's going to go, at least in my mind. Now, how GDPR works out in the long run, and you know, how that spreads beyond, it's a very different approach, certainly.
The thing that I was just thinking about, somebody on the conference asked a very, I would say, European question, which was like, if you're not on WeChat, do you exist as a Chinese person? And then that's an interesting thought experiment, as in, if you wouldn't be capable of affording even the cheapest Android phone, if you wouldn't be capable of participating on the WeChat ecosystem and platform, how inconvenient would be life for a Chinese person?
Yeah, so I think there's kind of two different sets of people that you would have to look at. I mean, there's the people in the big cities that are disenfranchised or financially excluded, and there's people in the countryside that are financially excluded. And I think in the countryside, the financial ecosystem around those individuals is tailored towards those individuals. So, you know, it's much more cash once you're outside of the city. When you're in the city, it's kind of a different story, and it becomes a little bit more, you know, it's the haves and the have-nots, and that reality is a little bit more black and white in the cities. Even so much so that foreigners come, when they come to Shanghai, become more financially excluded.
Well, to be honest, when we were in Shanghai last year, we felt like completely out of the loop. I mean, you want to order a cab. There's no way of ordering a cab. You can't pay for... You want to go into this Amazon Go store that is there pretty much next to every single hotel. You can't get in because you're not part of the system.
Yeah.
That is kind of mean.
Yeah.
If you're a foreigner, arena and you actually can't play, and you can't even pay to play because there's no way for you as a foreigner to go into this ecosystem. Now, the data sovereignty part, that is something that has been really discussed quite lengthy also on the conference on the Money 2020 here, which is something that, similar to, I don't know, a couple of years back, every Southeast Asian country started to build their own national debit card scheme, right? So everybody started to do their own thing. Now, everybody is, and it feels more like being afraid of the US Americans. Everybody wants to have the data sovereignty, so you have to have all of the data that is grabbed inside of the country and belongs to the citizens of the country needs to stay within the country. Is that, at the same time, it feels like very... Don't get me wrong, but nationalistic. Like, and I'm thinking about my country. But the one thing that you see is this region, the whole ASEAN region, is so interesting. Isn't there something like a push towards, you said before, there is no SEPA for ASEAN, but doesn't it make sense to do that in this region?
I think there are some basic challenges that we need to get through first. I mean, that vision is very beautiful, and you know, maybe in 50 or 100 years it'll appear. But fundamentally, the differences between the countries here are quite significant, mm-hmm. In terms of culture, language, religion, regulations, financial systems, you know, levels of development, All of these other things. And one of the reasons that Singapore managed to stay so competitive is because the surrounding countries aren't.
Yeah.
There's problems of crime and corruption and things like this in many of the neighboring countries. So Singapore has managed to avoid some of that and becomes standing out in that regard. Yeah. So I think all of those things will be challenges going forward. But, you know, potentially as we see financial integration, so more like the ASEAN payments network, we could see that be a basis on top of which these other things to have a kind of Asian economic zone, mm-hmm. where data is shared and there's a little bit more trust between the countries. But I think for historical reasons and current political reasons, I think that's pretty far off. Despite the challenges that Europe has had over the past century in terms of conflicts and everything else.
In the 90s, we had all of this rumbling about the tiger states coming into play, and it felt like it could be the BRICS or the Brazil, India, China thing. It felt like something was coming together, but then it was like a couple of years, and then everything with the financial crisis here in Asia, everything went away right away afterwards again. Yeah. So, but it's an interesting point of view. Now, we're coming to the end of the podcast, and of course I still want to ask you one last thing in good old Steve Jobs, rest in peace, mania. What are the things that we are not seeing? What is the one thing that you say for the next 12 months that is something that is not on the radar yet, but it will be already visible next year?
I think it goes back to the way we started the podcast. I think it just in general, you know, for Western bankers or, somebody in Europe who's never been out to Asia to see the level of development here, digital in general is changing the nature of the way that 3 billion people that make up this region conduct their financial lives. Mm-hmm. And it's starting with payments. Mm-hmm. You know, payments are providing that basic level of infrastructure that on top of which all of these other products or services are being leveled. You bring data into that, and that brings the idea of situational finance. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we've been talking about for years. You know, the ability for we would think traditional financial institution to better serve their clients by understanding the products and services that this person needs, mm-hmm. the right product, the right person, the right time. Mm-hmm. That dream or that destiny is being fulfilled, but not by the financial institutions. It's being through these third parties. And I think that really is a consideration. You need to think about what as a financial institution, what your role is in that place. I was on a panel a year and a half ago with the CFO of Lufax, and he made the comment, there is no fintech, there's only China fintech. And what he was saying was that, you know, when we look at the disruption that was promised through fintech a number of years ago, we're not really seeing that. We're seeing that in certain areas, like cross-border payments. You know, you have companies like TransferWise that are being very successful, or robo-advisors in certain markets are capturing a certain amount of market share in AUM. But realistically, the wholesale displacement of banks is not happening globally.
Sure.
But in Asia, it's a reality. This disruption is a reality. And it's with these new digital models where these organizations are able to completely disrupt the way that individuals and increasingly companies handle their financial lives. And so I think it's useful, whether you're a bank in Germany or it may sound far off, but for Chinese banks, this is a reality. Mm-hmm. They've lost the game in retail payments. Mm-hmm. Now they're playing to defend the rest of their business. Mm-hmm. And how traditional financial institutions react to that and what their role is in the future is really critical.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Zenon, I think we could go on rambling for the next hour and a half, but we have to come to an end eventually. So thank you very much for being part of the podcast. And again, just to make sure that everybody knows, so we will be hosting Zenon's content from his company on payment and banking coming next. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, das war der Podcast soweit aus dem schönen, warmen Singapur. Wie immer, nicht möglich ohne unsere Sponsoren. Vielen Dank an Mastercard und Smartsteuer. Wenn ihr mehr über Smartsteuer erfahren wollt, geht bitte auf smartsteuer.de/fintech. Viel Spaß euch noch!
FinCompare versorgt Banken also mit bonitätsstarken Kunden zu geringen Kosten?
Ja, FinCompare hat aber noch weitere Vorteile für Banken. Über unsere Plattform können Banken ganz einfach mit KMUs, Maklern und Beratern zusammenarbeiten. Die Banken können so den Kunden langfristig betreuen und haben immer einen perfekten Überblick über den Finanzierungsbedarf. Als Marktnetzwerk ermöglicht FinCompare so eine Win-Win-Win-Situation für Banken, KMUs und Berater.
Sie sind neugierig geworden?
Dann treten Sie gerne unter www.fincompare.com mit uns in Kontakt.